Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
You are now listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris, where the most influential voices in horror cinema will spill their guts to the renowned horror director, writer, and producer. Now, here's your host, Mick Garris.
From Nice Guy Productions World Headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is Postmortem. It's a great time to be a horror fan. There has never been such a wide diversity of creative voices behind the camera. Every year, there are more and more filmmakers of varied gender and ethnicity, drawing upon unique life experience and varied points of view. But it's not always been that way. As recently as the 1980s, you could practically count on one hand the successful female directors of horror films. The genre has long been run by the white male point of view, and I've actually been in meetings with studio executives, thankfully in the darkening past, who actually said to me that women can't make horror movies. They have been proven wrong time and time again, and now more than ever. But back in the 80s, when I was getting my start, few female directors were given the opportunities, particularly in our genre. But the few were notable. Amy Holden Jones did Slumber Party Massacre for Roger Corman. Kathleen Bigelow, who later won an Oscar for The Hurt Locker, created the masterful vampire saga Near Dark. Jackie Kong with Blood Diner. The opportunities were slim. And then we closed out the 1980s with Mary Lambert's muscular adaptation of Stephen King's Pet Sematary in 1989. These were trailblazing women who put a lie to that dusty canard that horror was men's territory. I mean, everybody really should have known better. Wasn't it 18-year-old Mary Shelley who wrote Frankenstein way back in 1818? Mary Lambert is with us today with a long list of nonstop accomplishments in film and television in her back pocket, and we'll talk with her about her inspirations and influences and challenges in Hollywood and beyond. Mary, thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome. It's great to have a visit with you, Mick.
Yeah, it's been way too long. It's time to catch up. So, Mary, you came from Helena, Arkansas, and you studied at the Rhode Island School of Design. So was your family artistic? I know your father was a farmer, was he not?
That's true. I was told once a long time ago by a fortune teller that I was put down in the wrong nest. I was about 16 or 17 when she told me that. And I think that might be true. She said I was put down in the wrong nest. I was put with in a situation where I would be firmly anchored to reality and to the earth, because otherwise I might just fly away, float away. Maybe she said float. It was not a family of artists or writers or actors but. There is, in the South, where I grew up, a very, very strong tradition of storytelling. And I think that was a huge influence on me.
Well, were you always interested in the visual arts? Is that something you wanted to do from childhood? Were you a movie fan?
From the time I was 5 years old, I wanted to be an artist. I thought I wanted to be a painter. I still am a painter. Yeah. In the last 10 years, I've been actively pursuing my craft as a painter, more so than I have since I was at Rhode Island School of Design. And in terms of the movies, I went to the movies. I went to every movie that came to the small town I lived in. And you know, I don't want to tell everybody how old I am too many times, but there was
you and I are the same age.
There was no, you know, there was very limited television in the late 50s, early 60s. And my family didn't even have a television until I was about 6 years old. I used to walk over to my grandmother's house to watch television, to watch Saturday morning television and to watch King Kong and the most reliable movies on television at that time were old horror movies, King Kong and Frankenstein and Dracula.
Right, all the Universal package. Were you always drawn to the darker stuff over the comedies and the dramas and the Westerns and the war movies?
That's a tough question, because that's what was there. That's what was interesting. Yeah. I did have to sneak out of the house to see the Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe movies at the local theater, because my mother, who was constantly telling me I couldn't do things, but then she didn't really follow up on it. She had too many other children, I think.
Right. Well, you have a younger sister who became a senator from Arkansas.
Yes,
she was Blanche Lincoln.
That's true. Blanche was much more law-abiding than I ever was. And she still is. And she was a wonderful senator. Wonderful senator. I love her very much.
Were you the troublemaker in the family, or you were the black sheep, or the white sheep, or shades of gray?
Well, I think you could say I was the black sheep, but I was very careful not to get in trouble. I was really good at not getting into trouble. And I left Arkansas pretty much for good when I was about 17. Because I just, even though I love Arkansas and I go back there a lot, and the folklore and the landscape and my many friends and relatives there are all a constant inspiration to my work. There's so many people there that I love, but I don't think there wasn't a big enough artistic community there for me. There wasn't a big enough creative. There wasn't any creative community at all, except for, one or two friends.
Well, you're so steeply rooted in Southern Gothic storytelling. There is a real sense of the Gothic that is unique to the American South.
That is very true. That is very true. I had a great aunt who could tell you the story of the three little pigs, and it would last for half an hour, and it gruesome details about what the house is coming down. I would hang on every word and then beg her to tell it to me all over again.
So going to Rhode Island School of Design, was it with the intent of becoming a painter, a fine artist?
Yes, it was with the intent of becoming a painter, but it was a bad time in history to become a painter because painting was dead. So I just buried it in the pet cemetery, came back to life last year.
So how do you go from an art student in Rhode Island to becoming one of the top music video creators of all time? Let's talk about some of the artists that you've worked with, from Mick Jagger to most famously Madonna, to, you know, just so many people, Queensryche, Eurythmics, Sting, the list goes on and on. So how do you make that transition from fine artist to groundbreaking film director of music videos?
Well, first of all, RISD didn't have a film department when I was there. They started their film department the year after I left. But they did have film classes and animation classes. And I started, when I realized that painting was at that time in history, was just not the place for me to be. I realized all the great painters from antiquity. I thought, wow, if these people were alive today, they'd be making films. They're telling stories, these huge the David and the paintings in the Louvre, those painters would be, those are huge stories. The coronation of Napoleon, I still remember standing in front of that painting and thinking, this painting takes 15 or 20 minutes kids to even begin to look at this painting. There's all these things are happening. There's the little boys, there's the birds in the belfry, there's the emperor, there's all these things, and you have to look at them and see how the people are related and what's going on. And there's an element of time here. And if this guy was alive today, he'd be making a film about this. He wouldn't be doing a painting. And so that became my desire at RISD was to become a filmmaker, but I had no inkling about the film industry at all. They didn't teach anything about how to become a director. Everything was centered towards being like a, you know, an avant-garde filmmaker, if anything. I learned some real cuckoo stuff there. And so when I moved to Los Angeles, I didn't really have a direction. I had this idea that I was going to make short films and people were going to buy them and play them on their on their Laserdisc players.
I remember Laserdisc very well.
But I was going to make short, very artistic films that included animation and that were nonlinear and more like paintings, really. And I had so many friends who were musicians at the time. And then one day somebody walked in. I was, you know, doing garbage mats for animation at a studio in Hollywood.
So a garbage mat is where you do a very basic blocking out of what's behind the image you want to see in the frame in a film.
Yeah. Or block out something you don't want to see. Right. Either way, it depends on whether it's going to be used as an in-camera mat or whether it's going to be used, you know, on artwork or whatever. But you do it with an airbrush, and I was good with an airbrush. So someone brought a music video. One of the very first ones I ever saw was a Ricky Lee Jones music video, Chucky's in Love.
Oh, yeah.
That was a great video. And I was like, when I saw it, I thought, wow, this is kind of like what I want to do. You know, this is what I think I can do. And
so it's visual arts, but not necessarily in a linear sense. It's what would have been created by the great painters of antiquity had there been the technology to do so.
It's sort of, I mean, at the time I was working on a short film, what I thought would be a short film that was very nonlinear. You know, about this girl that comes to Los Angeles, and she it involved tarot cards. It was and I ran out of money. I didn't have any money to finish it. I was using short ends from the the effects house where I was working. Nobody knows what short ends are anymore either.
Yeah, it's what's left over at the end of a reel when people are shooting on film.
Yeah, and they don't want to take a chance on running out of film, so during the next take, so they just break it off, and then there's like 10 feet of film or 25 feet or sometimes 50 feet of film left on a reel, and they sell them real cheap or give them away. So anyway, I decided to take this footage that I had. This film that was sort of unfinished and make it into a music video for some friends of mine. And I did, and it was successful and people started hiring me. And I
what was that first one?
It was for Tom Tom Club. It was for my friends, Tina Weymouth and Chris France and their band, the Tom Tom Club. And
which came out of Talking Heads. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Have you seen the re-release of their movie? It's unbelievable.
Not yet, but
it's like going to that concert.
Wow.
I know I went to that concert 12 times, maybe 15, maybe 20. I don't even know how many times I went to see that concert back in the day. So anyway, that video that they liked it at Warner Brothers, and they started hiring me to do music videos, and I was good at it, you know, because I didn't have a lot of I hadn't gone to film school. I didn't have a lot of preconceptions about how narrative films are made. And so I just approached it like, I approached each song, you know, I approached the emotional narrative, and I was good at it. I got along with the musicians. That's something I knew how to do.
You basically approached it all with an open creative mind, and you happened to be connected to what was one of the largest recording companies in the world at Warner Brothers, who had so many of the most important artists.
That's true.
So tell me some of the ones that really stand out in your memory. I mean, probably people know you most for your Madonna videos, but there was so much more than that.
Well, I love the one I did for Sting.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Pope shot that video in black and white, and it was sort of an homage to Orphée, the Cocteau movie, which is one of my favorite. Well, I have so many favorite movies, but...
Yeah, such a great movie. And all the backwards motion and the slow motion and all of that is so remarkable and fresh in that video.
And the story itself, the myth of Orpheus going to hell to rescue his wife, to rescue Eurydice. That one, I just felt like that was successful in so many ways. And the dancing in it, I was really proud of the choreography. And I think, you know, we used the choreography to help tell the story, which I think is an important element to successful choreography is that it moved the story forward just as much as a scene would. If you just stop the story and then a bunch of people dance and then you pick up the story again, that's fun to look at if you really like to watch dance, but it doesn't to me it's not as successful as if the dance moves the story forward. That was one. And we went the Janet Jackson videos, where I used a lot of the same dancers. I started to use, you know, some of the same dancers and some of the same choreographers. Kenny Ortega.
Ortega, yeah, who directed Hocus Pocus, which I wrote.
Oh my God. That's one of my favorite movies, Mick. I've watched that movie so many times. The choreography in that is so amazing, just because another thing that I really believe about choreography is that it doesn't have to be, it's really more just about hitting the beats than it is about how extreme the moves are. I mean, that scene where Bette Midler and Sarah, and the three of them are walking
down the street.
All they're doing is walking, but they're just doing it in the apps and their body gestures and the way they're doing it. That's just so amazing.
Kenny brought so much to it as a choreographer. Yeah. I mean, he really, the film was not written as a musical and isn't a musical, but it is so musical and it's choreographed as much as it is directed.
And, well, Kenny really knows how to tell a story with dance. Yeah. The opening sequence to The Descendants, where they sing Show Me the Way to Be Bad. What is it? Something about bad. I'm so bad. I don't remember. But it's Show Me the Way to Be Wicked.
Ah, yeah.
That's it. So many ways to be wicked. That's
so many ways, even
so
better.
Many ways to be wicked in the whole high school dances. Oh my God, I love that. I love that that particular opening sequence.
Music is so great to tell stories through song and to marry visuals to song. Now it's hard to divorce visuals from music. You know, people listen to their song lists, but they watch music as much as they listen to it. I've only worked on one music video. Well, I've worked on two. I was one of the zombies in Michael Jackson's Thriller, but I also directed Michael in what was to become, 3 years after I did my work on it, Ghosts, Michael Jackson's Ghosts. And it's the most expensive video of all time, but we shot for 2 weeks before we had to shut down when Michael's first scandal broke. So 3 years later, they finished it with Stan Winston directing. But it's something I've always wanted to do. I was a singer in a band in my youth and would love to have that opportunity. But somehow it never happened other than that one time with Michael. So I guess I started from the top.
Yeah, I mean, where do you go from there, Mick? Yeah,
to the gutter. So how
lots of my friends are down there too, so
I'm happy to live in the gutter with us gutter snipes, the horror crowd, you know, the ones with no respect. But so musical imagery, tell me how you would work, how your plans were. Did you do lookbooks? Did you get pictures from magazines or film clips or what that inspired you, or was it entirely self-generated, or did it work with the artist?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of different every time. The more that I would be able to or allowed to work with the artist, you know, usually the better the video was. That became more and more difficult as time went on, because the competition for the jobs would get bigger and the studios wouldn't let you talk to the artists sometimes unless you had a previous relationship with them, and you just have to write concepts without any guidance at all. But you know, they usually start with writing a concept back in the day. And sometimes that would include storyboards. But more often it would just be a written concept. And then once it was going forward, sometimes I would do drawings or even little paintings to show what I was trying to accomplish. On pictures and but a formal lookbook, I don't think I ever did a formal lookbook. I hate them.
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I agree.
It seems like you're doing homework. I really enjoyed storyboarding.
Did you do your own storyboards?
My storyboards are pretty abstract. I mean, I'm not I don't have the drafting skills to be David the painter to do storyboards that you can show a studio executive or an ad agency. But luckily, one of my closest friends at the time, and she's still one of my closest friends, she just came to visit me. She still lives in Los Angeles, Andrea Dietrich, has done storyboards for me all through my career. She's done them for every single movie I think every single movie I've ever directed that wasn't a documentary. Someday we're going to have a show. We're going to incorporate her storyboards, and then we're going to do clips from the movies. And I'm going to put my paintings in the show. It's going to be a great show.
That sounds great.
Doesn't that sound great? Because the whole idea of visualization is something that really interests me, you know, because it more and more it's really important in the film world with visual effects.
Right.
It's a part of the process. It's the discussion at the Directors Guild, you know, previs. Like you have to come up with a still image, and then you have to then you see it move and you see how it's going to relate to the environment, how the pieces of the environment, you know, that are digital are going to relate to the pieces of the environment that are not, you know, that are physical reality, and how the animated characters or the digital enhancements on the physical characters are going to, it's like, but somewhere it starts in somebody's head, you know?
Right. Well, and the great thing about music video is that you're not hampered by necessity to follow narrative, and you're able to be surreal in addition to real and just go for visual flourish just for the sake of the emotional impact that it has.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's, you know, I haven't really directed any music videos in quite a while. It's become a little bit corporatized. Yeah. And so many of the really big, amazing videos, the artists direct them themselves, or, you know, with a really good DP or whatever. So I haven't I really haven't done one in a long time, but a lot of times I would start with a, you know, just a couple of images, maybe found images or drawings or something, and get the artist excited about those images, and then, you know, build the narrative around them. And people trusted me to bring in the appropriate, you know, to embellish them in the appropriate way, to build them out in the appropriate way. And that's just, you know, that's what I would do.
Well, it's been years since you've done it. Would you consider doing music video today?
Yeah, I would love to. I would love to, but I wouldn't. I wouldn't go through this whole thing of writing a concept, and, you know, without talking to the artist, and without any that if trying to do it without any contact with the artist is just, it's just a fool's errand, you know, because you have to. It's so important, you know. You're not the most important thing in a music video is to make sure that you're not imposing a character on the performer.
Right. Because you want to give them the room to be who they are.
Well, and unless they want to be a character, like Madonna loved taking on a character. There are performing artists. There are who like to do that.
Yeah. Michael loved doing that.
Yeah. Michael loved doing it. To a certain extent, like someone like Katy Perry does that. And there are other artists that just, you have to either find the character that sort of embodies who they are, or you just have to like let them be themselves, you know, and tell the story around that, because it's ultimately, it's not about the story that you, the director, or anybody comes up with. And it's not about the costumes. It's not about the mise-en-scène. It's about showcasing that person that has written and performed that song that has meaning for millions of people, you know, and you've got to find the heart of it. If you don't find the heart of that, then, you don't do a very good service.
And some of these musicians transcend the limitations of music video or music itself, like Madonna going on with Desperately Seeking Susan and Shanghai Express and Dick Tracy and all kinds of movies.
Yeah, can we talk about Evita? She was so wonderful.
And Evita especially, yeah. And then Sting went on to a great acting career as well. So some of these musicians do transcend on the strength of their personality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important that you respect, you know, who they are, and not try to shove them into a character or a narrative that's not meaningful to them.
So it's more than just their name value. It's who they are and protecting a personality that they possess and can exude on camera.
Yeah, and allowing them to bring the you know, the power and the emotion to the song that they're singing, in a way that reaches their audience.
People often don't understand that directing is really a collaborative effort with all of these, that you are the one who answers the questions and gives the guidance, but there are so many other elements that are brought into it. You transfer your visual ideas through the cinematographer, through the choreographer, through the performer. Let's talk about the transition of being a very successful music video into doing your first feature film, Siesta, which is such a powerful and very stylish and very provocative movie. The preparation that music videos gave you for visual representation in a more than just standard kind of coverage is really evident in that movie, and it pulses with a real heat.
They're going to screen it at the Sitges Film Festival.
Oh, great. One of my favorite festivals.
I love that festival. I'm going to go. I'm very excited to see it.
Fantastic.
So the question is, how did, Siesta has a very, very nonlinear storyline, which is one of the things that attracted me to the script. And the soundtrack is Miles Davis. So the music is a huge, huge part of it. I mean, there's, you know, it's about a woman who is already dead, and she's experiencing the last, she's experiencing this whole vision of things that might have happened.
Kind of an occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge in a way.
A little bit. It's a little bit like that. She's experiencing, and she's meeting people who are like, you know, she meets people in this landscape that are angels or devils or figments of her own imagination. It's, you know, it's kind of up to the, to your own interpretation as to, Julian Sands is one of those characters. And
what a wonderful man he was.
Oh my God. I missed him so much.
Me too.
I was just devastated. By his
great actor and a really sweet human being.
Oh, he was such an amazing human being. I mean, he was devilish, very mischievous and capable of any of the craziest pranks you can imagine. But at heart, he was just that. He was such a spiritual person, and so I had a really amazing cast of people.
Ellen Barkin was amazing.
Ellen was amazing. Jodie Foster. Yeah. Martin Sheen is in the movie. Grace Jones. Isabella Rossellini. And everybody was really up for the ride of you know, portraying characters that didn't exist,
yeah,
you know, except in the spirit world, but or that and giving life to these scenes that were taking place in the netherworld of Spain. And we just went for it. The visual landscape of Spain, especially at that time, was really amazing because Franco had just sort of stepped down.
Wow.
And there was this whole renaissance of, you know, people in the streets, and clubs were opening, and but there was also a lot of stuff that was just kind of frozen in time for 20 years, you know, in Madrid, the buildings and the apartments and the houses and the village where we shot a lot of it. You know, when you talk about, I had an amazing production designer named John Beard, really talented. He worked with Martin Scorsese on The Last Temptation of Christ, I believe. He's done some really big movies, but he was a production designer for Siesta. But one of the things that was really great was there was just stuff that was already there. And he was really into figuring it out with me, you know, how can we film this bizarre garden? You know, how can we film this crazy interior? And then for the sets that we built, you know, we amplified that and made them bigger than the interiors, big and strange or small and weird. And it was really fun to work with him. We had a real connection, and the same sort of things excited us visually.
So how did the opportunity manifest itself to be able to make the jump to your first feature film as director?
It took a while to get the movie together. We just kept signing on more and more actors. And
this was your project. You were developing it, and then you were taking it to production company.
He had a really hard time raising the finances.
Totally independent film.
Well, it was Zalman King and Gary Kerr first were the producers, and then we signed on with Palace Films in London.
Steve Woolley
and his partners Chris Brown and one other partner whose name I'm gonna have a minute saying Nick Powell. We had financing and it would fall through. We would have someone would sign on, yeah, I want to do it. I'm not going to tell you some of the people who gave me their word were going to put up $1.5 million and then 3 weeks later decided they weren't, because I don't know why tell tales at this point in time.
Yes.
But it fell through, and I was just sitting there in London, and we'd even brought Ellen was even there, and the money fell through again. We were just staying at this hotel and waiting to go to Spain because we were supposed to leave, and finally we had enough money to start production, and we did it. And you know, I had a lot of creative freedom because the money came from the money that we used for production came from a man named Julio Caro, who raised it independently. And then we sold it to Lorimar.
And then the next big step is working with a studio. Now, I remember meeting with Lindsay Duran at Paramount before I had ever directed a film about possibly directing Pet Sematary. And it was before they'd met with you. I read the script, which King himself had written, which I believe was his first one that he adapted himself. And it's a great script. And I'm delighted that you got it. If I wasn't going to get it, I'm delighted that you did.
That's nice of you to say, Mick. I don't know if I could be that generous.
I'm sure you can and are. But King has it in his deals that he has to have director approval and the like. He's such a big music fan, and I'm sure Siesta was his kind of movie. What was your first conversation with King, either before or after getting the job?
Well, it was before, because I met with him. I had, I met with him at a coffee shop in Hollywood, and it was mostly about music, really. The conversation, now that I'm thinking about it, I think there were two aspects to it. One was that he knew that, and I was very clear that I really loved the book. That the book had been important to me, and that I really loved the script. And then I think he knew and felt and believed me that I didn't want to change it. I didn't want to come in and fix what was wrong with it and improve the story and make it into a film. I wanted to make his story into a film. I didn't want to make the concept of it into a film. I wanted to be completely true to everything that was in the book and in the script. And I think the other thing was the music. I think when he realized that I was actually really good friends with Dee Dee Ramone, and we would definitely get that. And I said, no problem. Dee Dee will write a song for us. And Dee Dee did write a song for us.
Yeah. Pet Sematary is great.
Pretty damn good song.
It's a great one.
I don't want to be buried in the Pet Sematary. I don't want to live life again. Poor Dee Dee. He had such a hard, hard life. And that, the Ramones music is so great because it's so simple. It's almost stupid.
Yeah, but it's one, also, two. At the most, there's three chords in a song.
And what a stupid, when you think about it, what a stupid, write a song for Pet Sematary. Okay. I don't want to be buried in the Pet Sematary, but you know what? It's so true. It's so stupid. It's so simple. And it could not capture the spirit of the movie any better. No more words are needed. He was amazing.
Well, having worked with him so much, I know that the further you get from what he has written, the shittier it gets. So you, after Pet Sematary, 3 years later, you did Pet Sematary 2, which he did not write and which was not based on a book that he'd written, but it's based on characters created by him. So tell me how that circumstance was different, because I assume he wasn't involved.
No, he was not involved. I don't think he wanted the movie to be made, honestly. And Paramount had a very definite idea of how they wanted the sequel to go down. I mean, I wanted to, and still want to, honestly, do a sequel about Ellie, because she's the only one that lived.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, a true sequel would be about Ellie. But that was still a talk about a time when women couldn't direct films. There was a long period of my career when not only were female-driven films considered unmarketable, but especially young girls. I mean, it was one thing to have a boy as the lead in a film, but to have a girl, that was just a big no-no.
Find one without. But tell me about those challenges that you had and the stupid things that I heard in meetings with executives. You must have heard much stupider ones than I did.
I don't know if we want to go there, Mike.
We don't have to name names, but I do want to go there.
Okay. Well, I mean, one of the stupid ones was like, I already said it, nobody, we won't be able to sell a movie with a young girl as the lead. Has to be a boy. That was okay with me. I love teenage boys. I love teenage boys. I loved them since I was a teenage girl. And their brains aren't fully formed yet. They make really strange judgments. They make really strange, bad choices. And then they have to deal with the consequences. And, that's what Pet 2 was about. Was about, like, what's the worst thing that can happen to you if you're a teenage boy, an adolescent boy? Your mom can remarry, get married. Your single mom can get married to a horrible, strict guy who's the sheriff of the town and who's a disciplinarian and who hates you. No. That's not the worst thing that can happen. The worst thing that can happen is you kill him, you bury him in the pet cemetery, and he comes back as a crazy, murdering goon. So, I thought that was funny, and I loved that. And I really wanted wanted this to be about the dark humor inherent in that situation. And I was a lot of resistance to that dark humor. I wanted the soundtrack to just all be my initial idea for the soundtrack was just electric guitar, nothing but guitar. There would be nothing but electric guitar feedback. Maybe you could throw the guitar at the wall for a while, but if you couldn't make the noise with an electric guitar, it would not be in the soundtrack. And when they heard my first soundtrack, oh my God, everything flipped out. Plus, which I was pregnant with my son during the shoot and post production. So that, that actually wasn't difficult. And until right around that period in post production when all of a sudden they hated the everyone at Paramount hated the soundtrack, and I was 8.5 months pregnant, and that was a difficult month. But John Goldwyn at Paramount, he was very supportive of me when I told him I was pregnant. I thought they might fire me, but they didn't. And I'll never forget walking into his office and saying, "John, I've got to tell you something." This was in pre-production, obviously. And he looked at me and said, "What?" I said, "I'm pregnant." And he said, "Mary, That's wonderful. I'm so happy for you. And how can you not love somebody? Like, how can you not love? It was such an immediate reaction. It was just like, it was an immediate reaction.
How do you deal with a studio when they are putting the brakes on to what your vision is or your sound is for the soundtrack of the movie? How do you deal with them without coming to loggerheads and becoming enemies?
How do you do it?
Try and make them think it's their idea.
That's one way to do it. I don't know. You just want to stay in the room.
Yeah.
If you leave the room, none of your ideas are going to be put forward or executed. So you just have to stay in the room.
Yeah, you got to know which fights are worth fighting and which are worth making a compromise.
Yeah, when you're going to lie down on the railroad tracks and when you're going to, sometimes you make a compromise and it ends up being a movie that's more accessible to a larger audience. And that's
everybody wants a success.
Do you want your work to be seen? Do you want people to watch it or do you not want people to watch it? And I think the question is, when does it not become your work anymore?
Yeah.
When does it become a, written and directed by a committee? And that's when you need to walk away. But I appreciate the opportunities that Paramount gave me with those two movies, and I appreciate the people that wanted to make a good movie, and the support I got, and I don't agree with. Have you ever agreed with every note you've gotten from the producers and the studio? And in some cases, I think I honestly think Pet Sematary 2 would have done better if they would have let me go stronger on the dark humor and the rocket and the bass guitar soundtrack. But I'm still really happy. I was still happy with the movie and with Clancy's performance Eddie was great.
So did you find yourself being typed as a horror director after the success of Pet Sematary?
Yeah, I did.
Did you find it to be a negative, or did it was it opportunities for you?
I was offered some movies I didn't really want to do. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because they were horror movies. It was because I just didn't like the scripts. And in retrospect, I probably should have done one or two of them.
But life goes on, and you make your choices and you live with your choices and you keep moving forward, as evidenced by your IMDb page, which is 88 projects long.
Well, so I'm lucky. I've been very lucky, especially in the last few years, to be working.
Yeah, well, let's talk about a lot of the stuff in the last few years has been television. For quite some time, you've been doing episodic TV. What's the difference between doing episodic TV and doing features? I've had my experiences, but I'd love to hear what yours are.
I don't think my experiences in episodic have been much different from your experiences in episodic. I mean, they've been different, but the fact is, with episodic, unless you're a creator on the show, or a producer director, or a writer director, you have to come in and follow the trail.
It's a pattern that's been set already.
Their pattern is set. The characters have been developed. The look of the show is there. Is the look of the show is something that everybody wants to keep continuity with. You can bring flair to it. You can have ideas within a framework, and they love you if you come in with an idea that fits in the framework that already exists. But there's a framework that has some pretty hard walls, and you can't push too hard against those walls. I just directed last year an episode for The Shining Veil, and it was so much fun because I was just in a real sort of creative sync with everybody. The humor is very dark. They liked my dark humor. The visuals are really important. It was a really fun, great experience. What I'd really love to do would be get in at the beginning and be a creator on a show and have the opportunity to develop those characters over a season, because films are limited in that you have to start. Tarantino does 3-hour films, but they usually, honestly, I'm sorry, Quentin, they'd be a little better if he would shorten them. they'd just be a little better if he would just edit them a little bit. But I still sit through them. I sit through every minute, and sometimes I see them twice because they're brilliant. Yeah. However, a 3-hour film is still shorter than a 12 or 14 episode season, or even a 10 episode season.
Right.
And you don't have the for each hour of or half hour for that matter. Usually half hours are not an unfolding story. Usually half hours are like sitcoms or procedurals, but you have the opportunity. You're not expected to wrap this character up and leave us with a satisfying resolution for the rest of the life. You don't have to do happily ever after, and you don't have to do everything's dead and gone and it's all over. You leave the door open for the next thing that's going to happen, and that's my style of storytelling, really. I mean, I hate endings that are too I like ambivalent endings to movies.
Not wrapped up with a tidy bow.
Yeah, I like the idea that the audience can project onto it and think, well, what's going to happen next? You know, how is she going to go back home after everything that's happened? You know, how is he ever going to stay married to this woman?
Right. Going through the hills and valleys and not just one up and one down.
How are they going to, are they going to have children? Is the kingdom going to prosper? I mean, whatever it is, you know, leave you with that, leave you with some ambivalence about what the future might hold.
Yeah, the only two series I've had produced have been anthology series where it's one full movie each hour.
And you never, ever hire me for those, Mick. I
always wanted
to do one.
Not yet.
Okay.
I've got stuff in the works. I'll promise you one of those.
All right.
But they are not anthology. One of them is an anthology that Clive Barker and I are working on. But another one is...
I love Clive Barker.
Oh,
I've always wanted to work with Clive Barker.
As an artist and as a human.
And you know what? He's a great painter.
Great painter.
His paintings are amazing.
He painted the cover of my first book, and I have the original artwork in my house. But anyway, I know you have to run quickly. What is the one unfulfilled dream that you have? Is it to create your own series?
Yeah, I would say yes. I mean, I would like to do another movie from a script that I've written, you know, that's a little more like Siesta, even though I didn't write Siesta, that where I really have, you know, the creative freedom to kind of go. But I got to do that. And
you had the Dark Path Chronicles.
I did the Dark Path Chronicles, and that was very much mine. But I've never really had the freedom on a series to be part of the creation, be one of the creators, and that would be something that would be very, very meaningful to me.
Well, Mary Lambert, thank you so much for joining us here and going over your past and history. There's a lot more to talk about, and we'll do that in the future.
There's always tomorrow.
There is.
This isn't a hard ending. Anything
That's
can
right. This is just
Anything
an episode.
Can okay, dear.
All
it
right,
was
take
really
care.
Fun to visit with you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Postmortem with Mick Garris is produced by Mick Garris and Joe Russo. Our sound engineer is Christopher Leon Price. Our announcer is Jeff Gelb. Our graphic designer is John Holland. And our theme was composed and performed by Bill Burney with additional music by John Jasensky. If you're enjoying our show, please take a moment to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.